program does not create an attorney-client relationship between Moss and Barnett, a professional association, or any attorney appearing on this program and any caller or listener. Please remember that we can only give general information, and every case is unique. Always check with your individual attorney for any specific legal concerns. If you are in need of specific legal advice or are looking for an attorney, please do not hesitate to give Moss and Barnett a call at 612-877-5000.
This is WCCO's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
We are underway. Another lovely Saturday here in the Upper Midwest. Tom Schroyer is in studio. Steve Thompson is in studio. It's been a while. It has been several weeks. Good to see you, Tom.
It is great to be back, Steve. Thanks for that. And yes, we'll have to work out our routine here again as we go on. And fortunately, in that regard, we're enabled today by having a return visit from Ed Weiner, who will be talking today about common myths and folklore surrounding divorce actions in Minnesota and throughout the United States. And in that regard, Ed brings particular preeminence here to our show, Steve, because he has been named as one of the top 10 divorce lawyers in all of the United States by Worth Magazine, as well as one of the top 100 attorneys of all sorts in the United States by Worth Magazine. Ed is as well a perennial super lawyer recognized by Minnesota Law and Politics. But I have to say, Ed, that one of your crowning achievements is the family law group at Moss and Barnett. I understand that now numbers a total of 8 attorneys.
Tom and Steve, thank you for having me on the program. Yes, we have 8 attorneys out of about 75 attorneys in Moss and Barnett. It's one of the most honored family law groups in the country.
And you've done a great job building that department to work at such a high level here in our area and throughout the Upper Midwest, as you said. And in that regard, of course, that follows from the fact you are one of the most energetic people I've ever met and had the privilege to know. You're an active performance athlete, endurance sports athlete, professional photographer, and also an avid gardener. Now, that seems like a bit of an incongruity to me, Ed.
Well, my wife accuses me of playing 24 hours a day, but actually I think it's 25 hours per day.
All right. Well, welcome back to the show. You were on here previously and addressed a number of important topics, including most notably antenuptial agreements, premarital agreements. And today we want to broaden the focus a bit here and take advantage of some of your expertise throughout the entire gamut of family law, which includes premaritals and postnups as well as divorce actions.
Steve and Tom, one of the concerns I have is there's so many urban legends about divorce in Minnesota and across the country. So many people don't know what the reality is that I thought it was important to address divorce myths and folklore. It's very interesting, obviously of great importance to people, what the system can do and how these cases are handled. And it is amazing to me when I hear people come in and they say, my friend was divorced 3 times, so she or he is an expert, and they told me, and then they'll say something which is completely wrong. So I thought it would be important to have people ask questions if they want to call in or text us, and that we address some of these issues.
Well, absolutely. And, of course, I suppose you hear the same questions over and over. I wonder what is the most commonly asked question that you'd put in the category of folklore or myth?
Well, I think the most commonly asked question is a concern that a person has that their spouse is so successful, so smart, so strong, so well-connected, that that person will have an advantage in the divorce. They frequently say to me, my spouse is, you know, this very successful and brilliant person. There's no way you are going to be able to handle him.
And it's typically, I take it, that kind of a gender divide?
It varies, of course, but we have that question asked for both genders because we have many successful people out there, both men and women, and their spouses who may be stay-at-home persons, and they're very, very concerned that I or their attorney, other attorney, cannot handle that person. And I explain to them it is not a personal wrestling contest between the attorney and the spouse. It is governed by rules, and those rules are determined by Minnesota statute and applied by judges or private judges or, you know, the system in place does not look at and is not influenced by the power, the success, et cetera, of one person versus the other.
I suppose that really touches back to a concern we've addressed here in the in our show in previous weeks, and that is the need to have and maintain an independent judiciary in Minnesota so we make sure that the mighty and the powerful are treated equitably under the law with all of these rights and rules applying equally to both sides.
Well, that raises one of the common myths and urban legends we hear, and that is that male judges always favor men, female judges always favor women. So if you have, if you're the opposite gender and you're in court with a male or female judge, you are told that you're at a tremendous disadvantage, which is not true.
How does that play out, though, Ed? I mean, that certainly would be a commonplace for people to think, naturally enough, that if they had one of their own gender deciding the case, that they'd fare better.
I think that judges, good judges, and obviously the hugely vast majority of our judges are good judges, they try to and do take their job seriously, and they are to base their decisions on the law and the facts of that particular case. They do not allow their personal biases in almost every situation. They don't allow that to get in their way. They certainly are not going to allow their gender to get in the way. So they try to do what they're hired to do, and that is justice. And that's what we see from the courts.
And so it is true, isn't it, that in family law and other areas of the law, we are governed by the rule of law, and that allows individuals to put aside their unique perspectives and biases in fairly applying that law.
Absolutely correct.
Ed, we're talking, I guess, about the formation of the relationship now, just the beginning of an attorney-client relationship with you or another family attorney. What should people be looking for in terms of how they're picking a lawyer, and how does that play out in terms of some of these urban myths?
Could I ask Steve maybe to pretend he is a disgruntled husband whose wife is having an affair and he's looking for a lawyer? What are you looking for in a lawyer?
Well, I think I need someone who's going to take her to the cleaners. I want it all. I want the kids. I want all the money. I want all the property.
So your divorce myth and folklore would be that.
How bad is my acting? Am I gonna get any sort of award at some ceremony later?
Don't ask me now, Steve. You'll be embarrassed. No, your acting is terrific. I wish I had your voice. It's fabulous. So your position is you want to hire the nastiest lawyer,
right,
who'll litigate the issues and punish her for.
That's right. I'm angry and I want her punished.
Unfortunately, that's a common theme we see with people who come into divorce lawyers. And the reality is that I kind of explain this sometimes as, well, you're slashing your wrists and you're going to bleed on her. The system is not set up to punish people. Our system, in fact, in Minnesota, we have no-fault divorce. So the courts are not going to try to weigh who was a better spouse, who did bad things, and that's not going to influence the result. If you hire an attorney who allows you to be litigious, unnecessarily litigious, and spend a whole bunch of money, that's only benefiting the attorney. What good attorneys in family law try to do is keep the emotion down as much as you can. You have to respect the emotion because divorce is one of the most difficult things people go through. It's among the top three worst lifetime experiences. But at the same time, you don't want to try to punish the spouse. You do not want to try to unnecessarily litigate because that just wastes time, money, emotion. And many people, where they have children, they want to be friendly in the future, at least, if not friends, so they can go to their children's weddings and all other happy events and not create stress for everyone present. So, no, don't hire the nastiest lawyer. Don't try to punish your spouse. That's a legend, a myth, that people think that's what you do in divorce. That isn't what you do. You try to reach a fair, reasonable settlement as soon as you possibly can.
We have more on the way. Ed Weiner joins us in studio. Tom Schroyer is the host. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett, available online at moss-barnett.com. We have more on the way. By the way, phone numbers on the program, 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. You can text the program as well, 81807. Our text service powered by Wellington Window and Door Company. Here on CCO, it is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett, each and every Saturday at noon here at News Radio 830 WCCO. Tom Schroyer, host of the program, joining us in studio. Ed Weiner today. Divorce myths and folklore. Our phone number on the program, 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. We'll go to the phones in a moment. We had someone who had a quick comment on the phone, didn't want to go on the air, but they brought up common law marriage. Is there such a thing in the state of Minnesota?
There used to be. Common law marriage was basically where people had lived together, held themselves out as being, typically they would hold themselves out as being a married couple. Minnesota does not have that. It was abolished by statute long, long ago, so long ago that I don't even know when it was. But In other states, it may exist in some other states, but here where people live together, what they need is, if they intend not to marry, they should have a cohabitation agreement that defines their legal rights so that if they split up, they can deal with property they may have acquired together, debts that they've incurred, etc.
Let's go to the phones. Mike in Malacca, you're on the air. Hello.
Yes, sir. I've got a question for you. In 2001, I went through a divorce. Actually, it was kind of a messy one due to marital problems on infidelities on my part. I went to see a lawyer at the time, and he told me that being a male in this at that time, that there was nothing that he could do for me. So I went to through the divorce with my ex's lawyer at the time and just kind of bit the bullet, for a lack of a better term, and have spent since that point 50% of my net income is going to my ex. And I was wondering what my options are as far as getting something a little more realistic changed, or you know, and I'm getting close to, I would say within another 5 or 6 years of becoming unemployed, or I mean retired, and wondering, you know, there was no time limit set on this the amount of money that I was paying her, and as far as if I was continued to work or retired or whatever, and looking just for some answers or some help on as to what my best recourse is at this point.
Mike, we cannot give any particularly specific advice to anyone over the telephone, so we can't talk about what you know, you might be able to do for yourself and what rights you might have. But I can speak generally. So generally, we have safety nets in the statute which permit modification of existing judgment and decrees. For example, if someone's paying spousal maintenance and their circumstances dramatically change where they can't afford to pay what they've been ordered to pay, you can go into court and that person can try to convince the court to modify the amount of the maintenance being paid. You did raise an urban myth there, and I was surprised it came from an attorney, and that is because you were, I think you said you were a man and had committed adultery or something. There was nothing that you could do. He could not represent you and help you. We have no fault in Minnesota, as mentioned, and the fact that you or your spouse, in any case, the one of them may have done something wrong, not been a good spouse, that is why we have no fault. So people don't get punished. Generally, you raised another issue, and that spousal maintenance is only for women. I think you kind of raised that in your question, too. That's not true. That's another one of those myths. There are many men who receive maintenance. And your former spouse who's receiving this spousal maintenance, obviously at the time you agreed to pay it. So if your circumstances have changed or will change, for example, in the future, and again, this is not specific advice to you, but a person could bring this modification motion to try to change the situation.
Ed, in regard to looking forward to doing a divorce and thinking about planning it, one of the myths that I hear anyway is that it's legally advantageous to be the party who starts the divorce.
That's interesting because there are many, many attorneys who say it is not. In fact, the huge majority of attorneys say it is not legally advantageous if you're the person who starts the divorce. That is, the label of petitioner is applied to that person. The place I see it as an advantage, and I do see it as an advantage, is if the case actually has to be tried. If there's a trial, the petitioner gets to go first. And when you go first, you can, knowing the other side's arguments, counterarguments, positions, you can take the wind out of their sails. You can put in your case in anticipation of their case so that you take away a lot of their arguments and positions. You can explain where your client might be subject to attack by the other attorney on cross-examination. You can deal with it first. So it all gets out and the judge hears it first. So I don't necessarily subscribe to that. I think it is an urban myth that you're in every situation, because 98 or 99% of the divorce cases settle. So if you have 98 or 99%, there it would be a myth to say you should be the person who starts. But in those 1 or 2% of the cases where you actually have to try them, I see an advantage being the petitioner.
How about, though, in terms of starting an action, in terms of the timing of that, does it make a difference in terms of valuing the estate? Is that date important for when you start it in terms of what the court looks at, in terms of how much the value is of a piece of property or a business?
To answer your question, there are many situations where it's important to commence a dissolution proceeding quickly. But in terms of valuing the assets, the valuation date is set by statute as the first pretrial or similar hearing with the judge.
All right, we have more on the way. Ed Weiner joins us in studio. Divorce, myths, and folklore. We have phone lines open for you. You can call the program at 651-989-9226 or toll-free 1-866-989-9226. You can text the program as well at 81807. Send your text to 81807. Our text service powered by Wellington Window and Door Company. We have the news and weather on the way. Then more Minnesota Law on 830-WCCO. It is Minnesota Law each and every Saturday at noon here on News Radio 830-WCCO, presented by Moss and Barnett, available online at moss-barnett.com. The host of the program, Tom Schroyer, in studio today. Ed Weiner joining us, divorce, myths, and folklore. Our phone number on the program, 651-989-9226 or toll-free 1-866-989-9226 is the phone number on the program. We've had a number of calls today, but people a little shy today for some reason to go on the air today. But nevertheless, some very good questions coming in during the news break. Ed, you brought up at the beginning of the program today that divorce is one of the three most traumatic events that someone can go through in their life. The person was wondering, what are the other two?
Well, the other two that I'm familiar with from studies I've seen: death of a child, death of a spouse. Yeah. And divorce is death of the marriage, and people suffer with all three of those events, of course.
One of the other things that came up real quickly from the break, a quick phone call, they didn't have time or a little shy, didn't want to go on the air, and it goes back to the previous call. This gentleman was paying alimony or spousal maintenance for an extended period of time, an open-ended time. What is it a reasonable amount of time for that type of maintenance?
The statute is quite clear that every case is treated differently. It depends on the facts of the case, the duration of the marriage, what people are earning, their needs, etc. Those facts are spelled out. The court also says that if someone can't meet the marital standard of living in a case that is a maintenance case, that the court shall order permanent maintenance. And permanent typically means until one of the parties dies or until the recipient remarries, or until there's a court order changing it. So there are many, not many, because the award of maintenance, contrary to the myth again, is rather a minor in terms of the number of cases. Nationally, I saw statistics a number of years ago, and these may probably have not changed. So it was only like 4% of the cases that spousal maintenance was awarded.
You mean in total?
Yes.
And so that means that neither side got what I would call alimony?
That's correct. In many cases, especially the way our economy and people going to work, et cetera, has changed, it used to be in the old days that the only recipient of maintenance was women because we had stay-at-home women and men working outside the home. And now we have most of us, of course, working outside the home. So many men receive maintenance and many women receive maintenance, but in many situations, nobody receives maintenance because it's not needed. They're both earning an income.
But again, we come back to the question the caller had a moment ago, and that is there are things that people can do once they've had a final judgment and decree of divorce entered to make changes in that if their circumstances have changed and if it would be equitable to do so.
Absolutely, Tom.
Ed, I know one of the things you wanted to touch upon briefly in response to an earlier question as well was, is there an advantage to being the first party to bring the lawsuit for a divorce?
And there's another advantage we did not get to, and that is the question of venue. That is where the case is brought. If you have in Minnesota people who live in two different counties, the person who starts the action, the petitioner, can choose that county. So, and if they live in two different states, and we see more and more of that, obviously if you're here in Minnesota, you'd probably want to start the case here rather than in some other state, depending on the facts. But at least for convenience, if nothing else, it'd be nice to be able to pick where the case is going to be.
I want to echo Steve's comment earlier that we are open for phone calls and text message questions or comments to Ed, who is one of the preeminent and most distinguished family law attorneys in the United States, is recognized consistently by his peers. And so it's a real privilege, Ed, to have you here with us today. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. How much do I owe you for that?
Well, we're partners, Ed. It all comes out the same, so thank you.
I already owe him football tickets. I don't know how that happened in the first 30 minutes of the show, but he has has his hands on my football tickets, and it was amazing.
I wish that our listeners could have seen Ed in action there negotiating those tickets away from Steve Thompson just because he can't use one set of them here for the Gophers this fall.
I'll be in Chicago. And
I threatened not to call on Steve. I said, I'm going to call on you for all these questions if you don't give me those tickets.
Well, and to the same point, if people are a little shy about talking to Ed for whatever reason, we do have our website set up at moss-barnett.com where people can email questions during the week. And similar to how we do it on the show, we answer questions back in a non-specific way. Steve, we have a question or a caller?
Let's go to Dean in Roseville. Dean, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello. I've been separated for 10 years and considering going through the divorce process now. And my question is the joint property considered to be at the time of the separation or at the time of the filing for divorce?
That's a great question, Dean. And a lot of people think that the property is cut off at the commencement, but the property rights can also be cut off at the separation. Now, a 10-year separation obviously is a very lengthy separation. The factors that go into determining the date of sharing, let's call it, would be whether the parties had actually separated out their finances, were actually living separately, and were not going back and forth trying to save their marriage and also kind of sharing the marital pot. If everything has been separated out, and again, we can't give you any specific advice, but generally, if you had a 10-year separation, in most cases it would be the time of separation would likely be the date that would be used to divide the property.
Ed, is it a commonly held belief in Minnesota and elsewhere for that matter that you practice that all of the property that is owned by the parties is simply split down the middle by the courts these days? In other words, that we in effect have common ownership of everything?
Is that the urban myth says that that's the case, but there are many exceptions under Minnesota law. We have an entire category of property called non-marital property. For example, what you owned before you came into the marriage, etc., inheritances. And those properties, of course, usually go to the person who owns them, but you have to be cognizant of that, plus you have to prove it.
Well, are there exceptions made by the courts nonetheless to even getting a large inheritance or a gift as being something that the divorced spouse can take advantage of?
Yes, and that gets us to another myth, and that is people say, well, my spouse gave me this gift, so I get to keep it in a divorce. Gifts between spouses are not the same as gifts from third parties. If you receive a gift from a third party, that would generally be non-marital property, and then you'd own it. It would be separated out of the marital pot. And inheritance is the same thing would apply. So that would be in the non-marital category, which means that you, the person who received that, would generally keep it.
Our phone number on Minnesota Law each and every Saturday at noon, between noon and 1 o'clock, 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. You can text the program as well. That service powered by Wellington Window and Door Company, 81807. That's 81807. Let's go to Steve in Plymouth. Steve, you're on the air with Ed Weiner and Tom Schroyer.
You were just talking about marital property and division 50-50 and that may be a myth. And I know you can't address my situation specifically, but have you ever had cases, Mr. Weiner, where property has been divided other than 50-50, other than for some of the reasons you just talked about?
Well, thank you very much for calling, Steve. Yes, I have. And, you know, recently I had a case where we had a settlement which was dramatically disproportionate. That does occur. People don't hear about that. Our law in Minnesota, and that's the myth. The myth is that everything is to be divided, shall be divided 50-50. That is not the law. Minnesota is what is called an equitable distribution jurisdiction, i.e. fairness. And the statutory law and the case law tells us what that means. And essentially, there are cases where it is not fair to divide everything equally. And I've experienced that in many settlements. And as I said recently, I had a gigantic disproportionate division. So it can occur. It depends on the facts and the circumstances.
I want to thank that caller for that particularly articulate question. And, Ed, we are also looking back at the question of, you know, timing of divorce actions. And I'm wondering, does it matter when somebody moves out of the home in terms of, you know, do they get better rights or worse rights if they leave the marital property, the marital homestead first?
Another urban legend. If you leave the home, you're jeopardizing your marital rights in terms of property, et cetera. That part is an urban legend and a myth. The court does not punish people because of something called abandonment, that is leaving the marital home. We don't have that in Minnesota. But there are some cases where you could jeopardize your rights to custody by, in effect, walking away from the children. Again, it's very fact-specific, and we have to know all of the facts to render opinions and judgments. A good policy to follow is not leave the home unless your personal safety, et cetera, is at issue, until you get some legal advice.
And coming into the program, one of the myths that I had in mind was, is that the mother, the woman, always gets custody. And I'm sure there's a lot of people that share that myth about divorce, that a father that may want custody has very little chance in this process.
Well, Steve, that's a great question, and it is a very common myth. And I think it is the result of what happened in the past. In the past, the way people agreed to run their homes was that moms would stay home and dads would be out working. Well, that's changed over the last several decades. We have many, many women who are not at home. We have many men who are at home as the at-home parent. And when you have a situation like that, there's not an advantage because you happen to be the stay-at-home parent. But the reason the myth was created is there was some reality to that, because the vast majority of women in the past were the stay-at-home parent and dad was the working parent. That is different nowadays, and the fact that somebody is home is important if that person, doesn't matter what gender, is the primary caretaker of the children. But that's different than what we're facing today.
One of the follow-ups to that is once a parent has custody and they choose to leave the state, leave the area, move on, they can do what they want. They have custody.
Well, that's a myth, too. Under Minnesota law, there are some people who come in and say to me, well, you know, I hate Minnesota winters. I can get a job in Florida. I just am going to pick up the kids and go. I was divorced 2 years ago, etc. The problem is that the court, of course, which is trying to protect the children in the legislature, we have laws that say that the best interest of the children is what determines that. And if they have a relationship with the other parent here and everything's going well, the children have stability in Minnesota, the court is not going to generally let them be moved to another state simply because that person wants to remarry, take a different job, or just get away from our winter.
We need to take a break. Ed Weiner in studio, divorce, myths, and folklore. Your calls welcome. We'll come back and take calls from Rita and Diane here on Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. We come your way each and every Saturday between noon and 1 o'clock here on News Radio 830 WCCO. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Ed Weiner in studio today. Divorce, myths, and folklore. Tom Schroyer is our host. Big thanks to Dennis Matuzak, our studio coordinator. Let's go to the phones right away. Rita in Blaine, you're on the air. Hello, Rita.
Hi, you guys. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for calling.
Good. Well, okay. So I know you can't talk specifically about my case. I'm going to throw something out there specifically to me, but then ask a general question. My husband is a non-U.S. citizen and is currently collecting unemployment here, but he actually has a lot of money over in his home country, which is how we've basically been living. My question then is, what is the best way to track down money or income that is actually hidden in overseas accounts that is being given to someone in large reoccurring amounts every few months or whatever? I've heard that hiring a forensic accountant is the best way to go, but I have no idea.
Rita, there are many ways to try to find hidden assets. First, we have what are called discovery rights in dissolution proceedings. We can ask the other party to give us information. Obviously, if they're going to lie, that's not a very good way to find them. So we do hire forensic accountants. There are many wonderful forensic accountants who work in the family law area almost exclusively, in some cases exclusively. And they do have the skills to try to find these assets. I do have something that's not an urban legend or a divorce myth or folklore, and that is if you're really dealing with a crook, the chances of finding assets that are hidden are not very good. That's the problem. But if, in fact, you can trace the money out of the estate, the court doesn't have to know where it went. If you can quantify that and say, well, for example, $100,000 is missing out of the estate, the court can charge that person, put it on a balance sheet, and say, well, we're going to assume you still have that, so therefore we'll compensate her by giving her $100,000 to balance that out. So, yes, the forensic account is the best way to go.
Ed, in that regard, though, even assuming you get a paper judgment, is it enforceable in divorce courts?
Yes, you can get, Tom, as you know, a money judgment, which allows us to pursue the creditor remedies that are available under Minnesota law. There are many ways to enforce judgments. Many people feel that it's automatic. It isn't. Work has to be done to enforce those judgments and make people to comply with the requirements of the judgment.
Back to the phones here on Minnesota Law. We go to Diane in Spring Lake Park. Diane, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi. Yes, my son and daughter-in-law recently moved to Soldotna, Alaska. The plan is that she's going to be, or she is living with her boyfriend. My son has, and they have three children, 8, 5, and 1. And the plan is to have joint custody, and he has gotten a job and a place to live. But my question is Alaska, I guess I know nothing other than my concern for my son, you know, getting a fair shake and everything as far as living in another state and moving out of state so soon before their divorce.
So, Diane, the question I think is, can he get a fair shake in Alaska? And I think Steve is admitted in Alaska, aren't you, Steve? Can't you answer that one?
I visited there.
Okay.
I was there for about 5 days doing play-by-play of a basketball tournament. That's my exposure.
Okay.
That's it.
That's more than I've had. Okay. The answer is what you need to do is your son needs to contact an attorney in Alaska, get some good advice based on the specific facts, and then make his decisions and try to reach a fair settlement.
Ed, would they be well advised, though, to try to get that figured out before they enter into the move itself?
100% accurate, Tom, of course. Maybe I misunderstood, Diane. Has he already moved to Alaska?
Place up there and a job, and it happened very quickly. She decided she wanted to go and took the kids, and he pretty much followed because...
Diane, that raises a very important point. And this is a point in many areas of the law, but especially family law. And that is, before you make a decision and implement it that may have legal repercussions in a divorce, get some legal advice before you make the decision, because you can deal with it better at that point and then decide the plan of action rather than going to an attorney. I refer to it as like a house. It's better to have the decisions made before you dig the hole rather than when you're putting the roof on. So please get advice before you take action.
And we're back again to the question of what to do in the event that somebody has a judgment, Ed, and they don't really feel like honoring it. What can somebody declare bankruptcy and eliminate their obligations for child support, for alimony or spousal maintenance, and for transferring property?
Tom, the questions about judgments are great questions because people think that once a divorce decree is entered, they don't have any work to do. And that's not true. To answer the first question, if somebody's not honoring a judgment, not complying with the judgment, we have to understand what a judgment is. When people reach a settlement, they are in agreement, and then that agreement gets reduced to a court order. Now it's the court saying, you shall do what you agree to. And if a person does not do that, then there are remedies in the system to force a person to do that, from money judgments to sequestering assets to actually incarceration if somebody is committing civil, they're not complying with the court order and therefore they're in civil contempt of court.
Does bankruptcy allow people to wash those out?
No. In fact, it allows some things to be washed out, but generally there are exceptions for payments ordered under decrees such as child support, spousal maintenance. You can't wipe those out.
Very good.
Well, the hour has gone very quickly. Ed, great to see you again on the program. Thanks so much for joining us today. It was fun.
Steve, don't be so nice. You're not getting out of giving me those tickets. Thank you.
I'll need to get some advice on that. I don't know where to turn. Maybe I'll have to consult with Tom after the program.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Ed.
Thank you, Tom.
Ed Weiner, Tom Schroyer. Tom, what do we got coming up next week?
We have a great program with Tom Sharon, an antitrust attorney at Moss & Barnett. We're going to be talking about all of the changes in energy being brought to the antitrust law enforcement arena by the new Obama administration.
Very good. That is Minnesota Law next Saturday at noon here on News Radio 830 WCCO.